You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 233 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion and no longer undefeated Seattle Seahawks. And I have to say, after 2 weeks of multiple health screens and asking everyone to quarantine, I'm still pissed off about that loss on Sunday.
Disappointed that didn't do the trick. Usually does. Well, you know what's coming this weekend? It's Halloween.
Oh, surprised me.
Yeah. I spooked you a little bit there. It's a trick. And as a result, we have a special themed beer this week. It is not a pumpkin themed beer specifically, oddly, but it is the Stone Enjoy By October 31st Double IPA.
Oh my God.
That you saw on the shelves.
At Costco, yes. So again, these enjoy by a certain date, themed with the date that you're supposed to enjoy them by. We've had an enjoy by 12/25 before, and this enjoy by 10/31. This is a 9.4.
Some of them are enjoy by and some of them are enjoy after.
There we go. This is a 9.4% double IPA.
That is correct.
So buckle up, people.
We may still be enjoying this on 10/31 as it turns out. Consistently delivered faster than any bottled IPA on the planet, Stone Enjoy By IPA facilitated a paradigm shift in respect for and enjoyment of hoppy beers by ensuring craft beer fans the ultimate level of freshness. We brew this intense double IPA with more than 10 different hops, employing hop bursting and dry hopping techniques to amp up the peach and tropical fruit notes and overall hop factor. Brewed specifically not to last, this devastatingly fresh golden beauty should be enjoyed within 37 days of the release date, which is September 25th.
Oh, they want it all. They've got the hops bursting. They have got the hops drying. 10 hops. They want everything. They want the Arby's franchises outside of Telluride. I've got this in my Escape 2 Crescent Ballroom Shouts to Phoenix, Arizona koozie. Let's get after it. Very smooth for a double IPA.
First off, a toast is in order tonight to Seattle Sounders FC, who with their win at Vancouver that we'll talk a little bit more about later, clinched a 12th consecutive playoff berth. That's as many seasons as they have played MLS soccer. The second longest streak belongs to New York Red Bulls, who are at 10 and can make it 11, likely will, because pretty much everyone in the East makes the playoffs this year. So, Sounders, a consistent track record of excellence that continues. And obviously just making the playoffs wasn't the concern for them. They're trying
They're not squeaking by when they make the playoffs. You know, they're going to the MLS Cup often at this point.
Absolutely. They had a tweet specifically about how they weren't going to change their Twitter handle to indicate they had clinched a playoffs berth, as many MLS teams did, because it's an expectation, not a celebration. But you still should toast to it, certainly.
A non-toast.
Also this week,
a lackluster toast.
It's a half-hearted toast.
Here is what we are going to have a not half-hearted toast for. What is that?
For everybody who's already voted for next Tuesday's election, which according to the returns of the state of Washington is the majority of people out there, hopefully the vast majority of the listener, and if not, hope you plan to do so by Tuesday.
I think you can comfortably say that we will not be recording a podcast next Tuesday night.
Yeah, I don't know when we're going to do it next week, but no, Tuesday is out. I don't remember what we did back in 2016. I think we recorded Wednesday night that time. It was a time to record a podcast. That was one of them.
Was that our first podcast?
No. It was like the second or third. When we returned. Yeah, it was early in the process, certainly.
Well, happy 4-year anniversary to us also.
Oh yeah, I completely missed the anniversary of that. That is, you know what? It might be today. It might be right around this, because
come to think of it,
it was after the Arizona loss 4 years ago. Or the Arizona tie, I should say, 4 years ago, which, as we looked up during the game, was October 23rd. The date of the return of the fabulous Pelton cast, you know what it was?
October 27th.
October 27th. It's Toad's 4-year anniversary.
Wow. Cue the Mark Morrison. It was the return of the Pelton cast. 4 years later, here we are delivering to you the same quality of content.
I don't, the audio quality has probably gotten slightly better than the last couple weeks when there was some static.
Oh, this week. It's better audio quality than a week ago. These are the standards that we've set.
It used to be pretty damn good audio quality back when we recorded in person. But,
oh, man.
Those days seem long, long ago at this point.
Well, again, if you haven't voted, get out there and vote. In fact, I would even, for one, say rock the vote. Okay. And
I thought you were going to suggest voting multiple times. I was going to have to disavow that.
No. I would not say that. I would definitely suggest that people do rock the vote, however, and vote early and often. No.
just early.
I mean, if you're like me, you got your ballot, immediately voted, and then returned it.
I didn't go quite that quickly, but I think today was the first day it officially showed online as being counted in the totals.
I've got to double check that.
Yeah, it's a fun little website. You can find out all the elections you voted in since 2004.
Wait, really? Does it show you what you voted for?
No.
Oh, okay. What's the website?
On the King County elections page.
It's like, did you vote for a winner or a loser? It's like, yeah, John Kerry. Sorry, boss. That's what I was talking to a band that I work with, who this is their first ever time voting in the swing state of Georgia, I'll have you.
There you go.
And I was asking whether they were going to vote by mail or whether they're going to go to a polling place. And they're like, they want to go to a polling place because it's their first ever time. And I was like, I did that for the first time in 2004. I voted for John Kerry for the first time ever.
I can still remember. I think we went in the morning before I went off to UW, and you were you at
Beverly Park Elementary, right?
Correct. Yes.
You and me and Jan, freezing cold in the morning at Beverly Park Elementary, exercising our right to vote.
I got to tell you, I do not miss that at all. Just being able to drop box.
Mail voting's so awesome. Yes. There was something about like fulfilling your civic duty in that time, especially when you're just passionate about a candidate like John Kerry, where you can go to the polls and vote for Kerry in person, and then subsequently throughout the day get more and more depressed. You know, there was something magical about that. All right, well, I'm on the King County Elections website. Where do I go now? I want to
track my ballot.
Is that under more tasks?
I can't remember how I originally found it.
Track my ballot. There we go.
There you go. Yeah, it's right there. I'll put the link as well in the post notes.
Okay, so here's the thing. I changed my name during this. We're gonna find out live right here whether I whether my ballot is counted. I changed my name, so I don't think they're having Tristan Pelton votes. Right?
I mean, if it's still under, is it still the same voter ID though? Did you didn't have to re-register?
What does house or building number mean?
So the number in your street address. Are you familiar? Is there a number there?
Okay. We got your ballot. Please check the ballot tracker tab for more information. Okay. They've got that. Here we go. Moment of truth. Track my ballot. Ballot counted. There we go. You are hearing it live here on the Pelton cast. Voting history. Here we go. Wow. They have it back to November 2nd, 2004, general and special election.
Yep.
You have voted in the fall. Look, I'm out here voting in midterms. God, who am I? 60?
I'd be interested to count up how many elections.
It says that I didn't vote in 12. It's got nothing in 12 for me.
Oh, no.
Which I'm pretty confident I voted, but 4, 6, 8, blank, 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 16, 18, 20.
You're gonna wanna fill in some of those. I've got 20, they don't count this year's the general election yet. 19, 18, 18, 18, 17, 17, 16, 16. There's a lot of them in here.
Wow, you voted a lot more often than I have. Man, maybe you should delete this part.
Look, it's okay. The important thing, we cannot compete in the past. The important thing is that we continue to vote going forward.
There we go.
And continue to enjoy the Stone Enjoy by October 31st, which is quite good. Should we turn our attention to Seattle food?
All right.
A little bit of lighter segment this week. I don't know. Do you want to talk about any place else besides Little Woody's?
You're talking about lighter quantity wise, right? Of locations we've been to, not lighter tonally.
Well, no.
Cause let me just say, we take Little Woody's Crunchwrap Supreme. What do they call it?
The Little Crunchwrap.
Little Crunchwrap. We take that very seriously. There's nothing light about that at all.
We take Fast Food Month very seriously. So this is the first time. Did you ever get the Baconator?
I did not get the Baconator, no. Which I have to say, I regret it.
You should. We're going to do a rankings here, and you should. This is the first time I've ever...
It's like my voting record. There's one piece omitted.
It's the first time I've ever completed the Fast Food Month cycle. Also the first time I've done the Little Crunchwrap Supreme, in part because I have never had an actual Crunchwrap Supreme at
Taco
Bell. I've
had precisely one in my entire life.
So I have nothing to compare it to. If they do a double-decker taco, I'll have plenty of comparison for that. But
you like double-decker tacos?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if they even make those anymore.
Yeah, I think they might not have made those after 1998.
I mean, it turns out that the Crunchwrap Supreme offers some of the value of the double-decker taco, which is... I like there is something satisfying about the crunch, but I don't like hard shell tacos because the shell. Yeah.
It's a soft and a crunch. You're getting both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say this is probably the lowest rated of the Fast Food Month burgers for me. What's if it? Only because the other ones are so high.
It doesn't translate particularly well, to be honest. Like having a burger patty when they did the crisp burritos from Taco Time, right? Taco Time inspired crisp burritos. They didn't try to fit a burger patty into those. And I feel like this fit a little bit more naturally having the burger patty in the Crunchwrap, but it still is kind of like, yeah, that's a lot of meat right in the middle for an item that, if I recall correctly from my few times eating a Crunchwrap, the majesty of it is sort of the intermingling of the ground beef and the cheese in the middle of the Crunchwrap. And it's beef. It is straight up just like a slab of beef on the middle.
I mean, a lot of the sauce ended up on the sides. If there was more of that on the top, I think it was a better experience. Now, you got queso fries.
My first ever queso fries.
Really? Did you dip?
Well, my first ever queso fries at Little Woody's.
Uh-huh. Did you dip the Crunchwrap Supreme, the Little Crunchwrap, in the queso fries? In the queso.
Did I dip the Crunchwrap in the queso?
I just want to be sure. I could tell when I was eating it. I was like,
I have a pulse still, something. Don't I?
This is missing something.
It's like,
and what is missing is more queso?
Yeah. Did I vote in the 2004 election? Okay. Yes. Well,
apparently you didn't in 2012.
I'm a little bit shocked about what I'm it's okay. We can't compete in the past. It's fine.
No, you definitely voted in 2012. I don't know why.
I wonder if, because would that have been my first election post name change?
Yes.
I wonder if how many times I changed my name.
Hopefully only the once.
Oh, Lord. I remember celebrating in the streets in 2012. How about that?
I remember picking you up after you were celebrating the streets
were you?
In 2012. Oh, yeah.
You picked me up? I kind of remember that now. What a night.
I mean, that was a big night.
Legalizing weed. That was huge. I mean, the city of Seattle, I think we did this on Let's Remember some years. In Washington State, we legalized marijuana, gay marriage, and Obama was reelected.
It was a big one, yeah. This is not going to be a Let's Remember some elections. I don't know if we're going to get into that.
We could do Let's Remember some elections. Do you want to do it here? I'm going to go through it really fast. Okay. Starting in 2004. Okay. So 2004, I don't exactly recall election night, but I remember the day after it. Cause I mean, we fucking hated George Bush at the time. I've talked about this in Let's Remember some years, and now it kind of seems like a likable guy, but it's interesting how time changes things. The day after being at Highland Community College was definitely up there with one of my most depressed days of my entire life.
I don't really have any strong memories besides for the actual physical voting. Well, I do actually have 2004. It was going to Sonics practice, and David Locke made the strongest case I've ever heard for partisan politics. Because when you're in college, you're always like, man, we need to be independent of these parties. Need to be just kind of choosing the best candidate no matter what.
Maybe when you were in college. Some of us are a little bit more enlightened by the time we got to college. It's fine.
And then he made an argument that it was like, look, I may not feel strongly about this particular candidate, but the people who are funding this candidate, I like them a lot better than the people who are funding the other candidate. And that struck me as the most compelling argument I'd ever heard for partisan politics.
There's also so much more to it, too, when you look at factors like the courts and stuff like that.
Sure.
It's a deeper issue. Did you vote in the year 2000?
I don't think I did.
Wow.
There was an event after class. I was a freshman at UW, and there was an event after class that I went to. And I think by the time I got home, it was too late.
Voting was not easy before mail-in ballots. Right? Like, now we take it for granted how easy it is to vote.
Yeah, again, mail-in ballots are the best.
2008.
I remember that night, though. I remember watching the coverage that night and not going to bed, not knowing who was going to win.
I do remember watching that coverage. I think I was too young to really even have like a perspective on anything at the time. 2008. Did you come over to my house on the night of 2008?
I did, yes.
And we got wasted on champagne.
I don't think I got wasted. I had to work the next day, but
we all got wasted.
There was definitely champagne.
They called it relatively early too.
Well, and the other big thing about 2008 was following the Nate Silver projections and how accurate they were. Like, that was the real winner of 2008 was Nate Silver.
You were definitely early on that.
Yeah, I mean, he was in a very, very loose sense.
Did you have a Twitter at the time?
No, that wasn't until the next MLK day. He was.
I always attach those 2 days too.
Shortly before the 2008 election was when Nate Silver was the one who contacted me about joining Basketball Prospectus. So
name dropping. Like,
very in on Nate Silver.
Name dropping again.
Yep.
But yeah, it felt like, I think they called it relatively early. Honestly, both of the Obama victories were called relatively early. And then it was one of those things where it's just like, they had to wait till a certain time. Whereas like, this poll is closed, boom, we can call it, right? Like, the networks knew what they were doing and they just had to do that. And then it was like that moment, everybody can feel it. And it's like that moment they call it. And then you erupt in excitement. You start popping champagne bottles. It's very exciting. Yeah, so 2008, I mean, you know, the whole campaign was about like change and hope. And I think we really felt that deeply.
I mean, it was a historic night in this country, a thing that, you know, to say you were alive for the first Black president.
12, we just mentioned. Again, I was in a crowded bar and then filtered onto the streets. It was one of those times that Pike brought Broadway and Pike, like, they just shut down the streets. People took it over. Prince is blasting or whatever. There was, and I can't believe you even picked me up because there were so many fucking people down there.
A lot of Macklemore, I'm sure, was playing. I mean, Same Love was the anthem.
Those are the best times when they shut down the streets in Capitol Hill and everybody is in the streets partying.
I mean, it was basically like a sports team championship that night. That's what it was.
It really was. It was like definitely the closest thing. Like, I wasn't there when people were celebrating the Seahawks victory, but that was the closest thing to it for me.
And then
2016.
You know what my standout memory of 2016 is?
What was that?
Nate Duncan tweeting about West Coast basketball games. God bless him.
Psycho. He was the only person just carrying on tweeting like normal.
My Twitter was a lot of people in their feelings, understandably, and Nate tweeting games.
Everybody was just like succumbing to the darkness. That's so funny.
He did have a segment on his podcast devoted to the election the next day, so he wasn't not paying attention to the results, but he was just staying disciplined on task. If there was games on, Nate was going to be tweeting them.
I think this was the first year that I remember being extraordinarily anxious throughout the day, which obviously, you know, the stakes were quite high. And it was one of those things where it's like, hurry the fuck up. Start telling me what's going on, you know? And also, like, between 2012 and 2016, I just became so much more consumed by information. And I think as a society, we became more consumed by information. We're like, give it to me now, you know? Or it's like, give me this thing that I want in this second. I'd like started reading the friggin' Reddit politics page and Twitter and stuff like that. And it just, you have to wait and wait and wait. And then starting to see as it was getting darker, right? Because this was post daylight savings time in Seattle. So it had started to get dark really early.
By definition, this year any election is after daylight savings time.
Yeah, so it's that moment right after.
I guess that's not true.
Well, this one will be too. And all of a sudden you're seeing the New York Times, the ticker, and it's just like starts at like 98% and then it's like 94, 92, and it's ticking backwards. And you're just like, it got to like 70 or something. And I'm like, it's fine. Everything is fine. And then it was like 40, 30. And I'm like, oh boy. And then I drove home from work at like 6 o'clock all alone. Everybody had left. I was there alone, just like pitch black and terrified, dead on the inside. Got home. I think it was called pretty shortly thereafter. And it was like 8 o'clock. And we were all just like, children, we're going to bed. we literally went to sleep at like, we watched some terrible Tina Fey movie or something. It was like 8:30 p.m. It's like, we're not paying attention to anything else.
Whew. So there you go.
Enjoy by 10:31.
Impromptu, let's remember some elections. Back to the Crunchwrap Supreme. No, I think I lost Tristan. I think that broke him.
Damn it.
Oh, and you're back. You're back.
Your transition made me turn on airplane mode somehow. That was the most Pelton Cast transition that has ever happened. That was impromptu. Let's remember some elections. Back to the Crunchwrap Supreme. Oh my god.
Little Crunchwrap.
This is the kind of content you know and love from the Pelton Cast.
I don't know if you're getting this 4 years ago necessarily.
Oh lord.
So my rankings of the fast food month burgers. We got to do this, obviously. I would say number four is, in fact, a little Crunchwrap. Number three, from the burger perspective, and maybe even still overall, as much as I love the curly fries, is the sourdough Woody.
Okay.
And then the surprise, number two, the little Big Mac, because the little Baconator won the month.
Fucker.
I offered it to you.
Did you? And I said no?
I'm sure I did.
Okay. I hate you, past Tristan.
You're dead to me. Up in the chat, so maybe
I don't think you offered it to me. I don't think you started offering me. But we got a good thing going here.
We do. We do.
It's over. I have the exact same ranking as you, except I didn't have the Baconator, so I just have the same 4, 3, and 2.
Okay.
But they're elevated to 3, 2, and 1.
All right. Well, we're gonna have to come up with some other stuff next week for our Seattle food segment, but I'm sure we will do so. It's time to turn our attention to sports. We'll start with the Sounders, who, as we mentioned earlier, won 2-0 in Portland against the Vancouver Whitecaps in what was technically a road match because the Whitecaps continue to play their home matches at Providence Park in Portland. That was on the heels of a 1-1 draw against the Timbers, the rival Timbers, on Thursday night that looked like it was going to be a loss for a large portion of this game. Portland scored early, then retreated into a defensive shell in the second half to try to preserve the lead. The Sounders had copious opportunities, but few good ones before a headed corner fell to Will Bruin near the left post in stoppage time, and he finished clinically to steal the crucial point, keeping the Sounders ahead of Portland in points per match in the race for first in the Western Conference. They then extended that lead on Tuesday with their win over the Whitecaps, their second at Providence Park this season, having beaten the Timbers down there in the first matchup the teams played after the restart. Couldn't break through Vancouver's defensive shell in the first half, but were afforded the first goal through Raul Ruidíaz in the 54th minute after VAR overturned an offside called on the field. Ruidíaz then set up Nico Lodero for the second goal shortly thereafter, and the Sounders cruised to the 2-0 win. It was the first match for Ruidíaz since his COVID-19 diagnosis while playing for Peru. And the other players that were on international duty for the Sounders, Javier Arriaga and Gustav Svensson, also returned to the lineup, as did Jovan Jones off the bench after missing time due to injury. Sounders did play without Will Bruin after his heroics last week due to an injury he suffered in training, although he would have been heading to the bench either way with Ruidíaz's return. So where do we stand now in the Western Conference? The Sounders are at 1.84 points per match to 1.74 for Sporting Kansas City and 1.68 for Portland. The Sounders and Sporting Kansas City have 3 matches apiece remaining, while the Timbers have 4 left because they were one of the few teams that did not have a match against Colorado canceled. 538 projections, Soccer Power Index now give the Sounders a 67% chance of finishing first in the Western Conference. So speaking of Colorado, the Sounders will play them on Sunday, traveling to Colorado for that matchup. After missing more than a month of play due to an outbreak of COVID-19 on their roster, the Rapids returned to action last Saturday, losing 4-0 to Sporting Kansas City. They will visit Minnesota on Wednesday and are still in position to make the playoffs right now if they're determined by points per match, as we expect. They sit 7th in the West in that metric.
2020.
Some OL Reign news. They were involved in a 3-team trade setting the U.S. women national team's Crystal Dunn from the 2-time defending NWSL champion North Carolina Courage to the Portland Thorns. This was a little confusing when I first read about it because it said this: the Reign had traded Dunn to the Thorns, and I had to stop for a second and think, did the Reign get Crystal Dunn at some point? And I just forgot about it. But that was not the case. They actually just facilitated this trade. Dunn had requested a trade to Portland, where her husband is the Thorns' head athletic trainer. The Reign ended up dealing keeper Casey Murphy to North Carolina and getting $60,000 net allocation money, with potentially another $50,000 allocation money coming if Crystal Dunn stays in the NWSL through next June, as well as a 2022 first-round pick. The Reign had depth at keeper with Michelle Beatos' return from an Achilles rupture that precipitated Murphy's addition, and they also faced the possibility of losing one of those two players in the coming expansion draft for Racing Louisville FC, which joins the NWSL next year.
There we go. Racing Louisville FC?
Yeah.
Is that two cities partnering?
No, I think it's like, you know, there's some... It's their equivalent of Sporting.
Interesting.
There's like a racing team somewhere in the world, isn't there?
Huh.
Yeah, there's one in Argentina, apparently.
Hmm. Cool. Yeah. I was thinking that because there's a city in Wisconsin, right?
Racine.
Yeah. I was like, maybe there's one in Louisville, so I don't know.
Yeah, there's a number of clubs throughout the world that use the Racine name.
All right. I like it.
There you go. Moving on to UW sports, starting with men's basketball. Coach Mike Hopkins addressed the media on Monday for the first time since the Huskies started practicing.
Said the team is preparing at this point as if Naz Carter will not be part of the team after his suspension for a violation of the intercollegiate athletics code. Although, you know, Carter has said that he's going to protest that decision. And of course, they're still hoping to get him back. Said the Huskies have revamped their schedule with a regional approach to non-conference play during the midst of this pandemic. We'll leave the state of Washington just once during that period and we'll host a multi-team event at Heck Ed. They saw their marquee non-conference games that were scheduled against Auburn, Gonzaga, and Oklahoma all canceled because of the changes to the schedule.
So do we know what the schedule is going to be at this point?
We don't. They have not announced that yet, but it will be very limited non-conference play because it's a 25 games. I think it's a 25 game season. And 20 of those this year, the Pac-12 is going to a 20-game conference schedule.
And the Pac-12 schedule is going to be generally unchanged, right?
Yeah, there was some talk of the possibility of teams just going to a single site. We haven't seen anything about that lately. I'm not sure what the plan is.
All teams going to a single site? Because education is important.
Not all teams going to the single site, but like basically when you travel, like the Washington teams, if they traveled to play the Oregon teams, they would both just go to Eugene and play all the games there as opposed to traveling back and forth between Eugene and Corvallis. So that was, I don't know that that's going to happen, but
that doesn't really make any sense to me as far as COVID protections, like the bus ride with the rest of your team. It doesn't matter whether you're in the Corvallis arena or the Eugene arena, right? Like you're riding with your team on the bus.
Probably not.
Yeah, that.
It's one of those. That may not happen. That was just something that got mentioned.
Okay.
You don't need to be upset about something that might not be happening anyway.
I'm just so upset about the notion that they're going to send all the players into a bubble type situation.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this, but conference tournaments were the original bubble.
What about the Biodome, though?
Oh, that's true. That was the original one.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, football, we now know the time for the Huskies season opener on November 7th.
We knew the time before it was announced.
Set for a 7:30 broadcast.
When I saw that, I was like, 7:30? Okay, great. Confirmed.
Checks out. I mean, it could have been 9 a.m.
Are we playing 9 a.m. games in the Pac-12 this year?
You sure are. The Huskies themselves may or may not be playing one, but Pac-12 teams are. Other than that, still no word on a starting quarterback. It seems unlikely that that'll be announced before the game. We're probably just going to find out. It'll probably be reported like 45 minutes before game time is my guess. There'll be a tweet and that's when we'll find out.
By Jimmy Lake or who?
No, I think by a media member covering the team.
Somebody covering the team. You know what? Talk to me about this 2020 Husky season after we can remember the 2020 election.
And after we can finish remembering the 2000 UW football season. Because Let's Remember a Season concludes tonight. Does Let's Remember some elections. As we go back to New Year's Day 2001. And the Huskies taking on number 14 Purdue in the Rose Bowl. But first, let's talk about the BCS championship that year. Because, man, if there were a year that we're crying out for a larger playoff than the two-team BCS championship of this era, it was 2000 when Oklahoma was the only unbeaten Power 5 team at 12-0. There were six.
Josh Heupel?
Yes, Josh Heupel. There were five Power 5 teams with one loss apiece. Number 2, Miami. Number 3, Florida State. Number 4, UW. Number 5, Oregon State. And number 6, Virginia Tech. Because Florida State rated better in what were called at the time the computer rankings, where they were number 1 in 5 of the 8 rankings that were used, the Seminoles edged the Hurricanes for a spot opposite the Sooners in the Orange Bowl, despite losing head-to-head to Miami. And Miami complained about this a lot, but of course their argument that we had the same number of losses and beat the other team head to head also applied to UW, which had beaten Miami for the Hurricanes' only loss that year. So I don't know if I quite buy that one,
This is just another, I'm so freaking sick of college football. I swear to God, like, it's just a really, it is the worst sport.
I think we'd probably find some worse sports.
The way that it is set up is so completely illogical. It was a sport where at the end of the year, they were just like, yeah, take a bunch of corporations and have them pay for two random teams to play each other. And then also have those games be like sort of determined by conference finish, but also based upon who corporate interests feel best about.
I don't know. Corporate interests. I don't think that I don't know who's sponsoring the Orange Bowl at that point. FedEx. I don't think FedEx was really putting its fingers on the scale there. Otherwise Memphis would have gone. I think the sponsorship post-dated all the other things that you're complaining about.
Who's going to be in the Meineke Car Care Bowl this year? It's like, it is ridiculous. There's no other league that does this. It's absurd. The idea of amateurism, and then all these players are amateurs, but then they go play in games that are paid for explicitly by name by corporate sponsors. But then also, they're like, hey, you know how every other sport in the world that has a playoff at the end? Let's not do that. Let's have some complicated rankings by old fucking white people.
I mean, first off, probably the people designing the computer rankings were young people. But second off, I don't know if you're aware of this thing called European soccer, where they're not real keen on
they all play the same table. They play the exact same teams as each other. You understand that, right? These teams play a totally random. Oh, also, don't fucking oversee who everybody plays. Just have them play whoever the hell they want, right?
They feel like.
If they want to play Liberty, let them play Liberty. It is the worst run sport.
I believe you're saying, give me Liberty or give me death.
Man, I think Syracuse might have gotten death because I heard they lost to Liberty. I have to hear rumors about what happens in college football games because I don't know.
This year, as long as you don't have an outbreak, you've won.
This is ridiculous. It has been ridiculous for two fucking decades. It's been ridiculous. Actually, well,
started being ridiculous in 2000.
I'm just saying that's the season we're talking about, right? And even still, Larry Scott is out there being like, hey, maybe we should have an 18 playoff because that actually makes some sense.
Because it's the only way we're going to get in.
Everybody else is like, nah, we're good.
All right, so scouting the opponent. Purdue won a down Big Ten at 8-3 with a 6-2 conference record. They beat number 6 Michigan 32-31 and number 17 Northwestern 41-28 to win a 3-team tie atop the Big Ten. They also beat number 12 Ohio State, but lost at number 21 Notre Dame, at Penn State, and at Michigan State. It was the only Rose Bowl appearance for Joe Tiller then in his fourth year at the helm of the Boilermakers. And of course, the big name on this team was Drew Brees, who was third in the nation with 3,668 passing yards. Wasn't all that amazing by advanced stats. He only averaged 7.2 yards per attempt. He also threw 12 interceptions because just, that's what you did back then. You threw some interceptions. It was fun. Here was the stat that shot. Okay, on the positive side, he completed 60% of his passes and ranked fourth in the nation with 26 touchdowns. And here's the shocking thing. Was number 6 nationally among quarterbacks with 521 rushing yards.
Wow.
I had no idea Drew Brees was a dual threat QB. This is why we needed to remember it.
That's really fascinating.
He had more rushing yards than Tui, as a matter of fact.
What?
I mean, this is
that is a freaking trivia question. Drew Brees had more rushing yards for the season than Marcus Tuiasosopo.
Yes.
That is incredible.
I mean, it's partially because one of the things that Drew Brees was really good at, even back then, was avoiding sacks. And
still.
And those count against your rushing yards in college football. But yeah, no, I mean, he clearly was doing a lot of running.
Proto Josh Allen over here.
95 carries on the year.
Wow.
I mean, first off, given his height, proto Russell Wilson. Vinny Sutherland was Breeze's top receiving target with 72 catches for 1,014 yards and 13 touchdowns. Running back Montrell Lowe was kind of just a guy. He averaged like 4.4 yards per carry. They had Matt Light at left tackle, who'd go on to a storied NFL career. And the defense featured several future NFL players, defensive ends Akin Adell and Sean Phillips, and safety Stuart Schweigert foremost among them. How the game went. The Huskies, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, got an emotional pregame visit by Curtis Williams a few weeks after his paralysis during their win at Stanford. UW came out strong, sacking Breeze on third and long on the opening drive and scoring on a Braxton Clemen one-yard run on their opening possession. They then made it 14-0 on a Tui run after a short field set up by a bad snap on a Purdue punt attempt. The Boilermakers got on the scoreboard with Breeze to Sutherland early in the second quarter, then added a field goal to make it 14-10 just before halftime. After a UW field goal to start the second half, Sutherland scored again to tie the game at 17 just 3 minutes into the third quarter. The Huskies would answer by scoring the next 17 points, starting with another John Anderson field goal midway through the third quarter. One of the most memorable moments of this game, late in the third quarter, Tui left the game with an injury to his throwing shoulder, and redshirt freshman Cody Pickett came in for his first meaningful action of his career. Like, he'd mopped up games. But I remember, like, this was like, oh God, Joe, don't throw. Like, what are you doing? But he completed a pair of passes for 11 yards in the three plays he played. Tui got a shot on the sideline and numbed the shoulder, and then came back in to finish the drive with an 8-yard fade to Todd Elstrom. The Huskies then made it 34-17 on a Willie Hurst run with 7:25 remaining. Purdue scored a long touchdown run shortly thereafter and got the ball back down 10 after a fumble when Tui, and I don't remember this play at all, it was a 30-yard run, and way downfield he attempted to pitch the ball to Willie Hurst.
Oh, my God.
But Purdue kicker Travis Dortch, who also would go on to the NFL, missed a field goal attempt, and Tui then picked up a key fourth down as the Huskies ran out the clock before Purdue could get it back.
There we go.
I mean, this was... Is it still the highest high for... I think it's still got to be the highest high for UW football in the post Don James era, right?
Absolutely, this is. I mean, you described it. Looking at all these one-loss teams, they ended up not playing one of them. And I don't think overall, aside from Breeze, that this Purdue team was a great team.
They were not.
They had some talent, but this wasn't like, you know, this wasn't them playing in the college football playoff and playing against Alabama or something like that, right?
No, it was not. We did not want Bama and did not get them.
This was the lowest hanging fruit of what we would call a New Year's Six game now that they've played since the Don James era.
Yeah, it was certainly the most favorable conditions for them to get a win. So, but you still got to go out there and do it. That night, by the way, also highlighted, we've mentioned this previously, but Oregon State beating Notre Dame 41-9.
Well, and so then following this game, both Drew Brees and Marcus Tuiasosopo are second round picks in the 2001 NFL draft. I mean, and one of those players is currently in the NFL still.
Oh, boy. One of them has been a Pac-12 assistant for a long, long time.
Seeing some of the names of people who are in that 2001 draft and just remembering how long ago it feels like they were in the NFL, or even like how long Corn Robinson was the Seahawks first round selection.
Wow. Did they have two picks that year? Was that one of the Joey Galloway picks?
It was Steve Hutchinson and Corn Robinson.
There you go.
Yeah, no, a solid draft. But like, even Mike Vick, who enjoyed a pretty long NFL career, feels like he's been retired for a very long time.
Sure does. In the Orange Bowl, the BCS championship, Oklahoma beat Florida State 13-2 in a not particularly memorable game. Miami went on to in the Sugar Bowl beat Florida 37-20 to finish number two.
And if there was any team that actually should have been in the championship, it's probably Miami.
I mean, like, we saw what Miami was the next couple of years.
They ultimately were a better team than UW was, but UW should have had a chance to play for it. And always and forever, there should be at minimum an 8-team college football playoff in the parts of a sport.
It would have been UW Oklahoma in the first round if it was the current format.
Where did UW finish in the computer rankings?
Oh, they were not very good in the computer rankings at all, because I don't know if you've noticed, as we've been remembering this season, they kept playing extremely close games and having to come back to beat mediocre Pac-10 teams that didn't go to the bowl game.
Sometimes there's glitches in the computer.
Oh, no. I don't think there was a glitch in the computer this time. By the way, I didn't mention Drew Brees finished third in the Heisman voting. Do you want to guess who finished ahead of him?
Vic.
No.
What? Wow.
I don't know what happened. Are we sure Vic was in that draft? Because he was involved in the trade for Drew Brees, right? Like, those picks got traded. He must have been, like, they didn't have the same team. He had been in the national championship the year before.
I think Mike Vick was pretty good. I'm just going to throw that out there.
He missed some time due to injury.
I have no idea.
Well, you mentioned one of them already, by the way.
Peter Warwick.
No, you mentioned one of them already.
Who did I mention?
The quarterback of the team that won the national championship.
Oh, Heupel?
Yeah, Heupel finished second. And the winner was Peter Warwick's teammate at Florida State, his quarterback.
Oh, Chris Wanky?
Chris Wanky.
Wow.
Who was at the time 28 years old.
It is kind of interesting to look back at this. When you look at this draft, that, you know, Brees was regarded highly. There was only one quarterback taken in the first round of that 2001 NFL draft.
Yeah, teams were not correctly valuing quarterbacks at that point.
There was also, there were three running backs drafted.
In the first round?
Yes.
Yeah.
There were more running backs drafted in the first round than there were quarterbacks, which is interesting.
I mean, LaDainian Tomlinson had an amazing career, Hall of Famer, I assume. But, like, Drew Brees, obviously, he already is a Hall of Famer, I should say. But Drew Brees, obviously, was the more valuable player in hindsight, and they were drafted 5th and 32nd, respectively, by the same team. So, you know. There you go. Do you have any other memories that we should talk about of that New Year's Day, of that game?
You know, I have pretty vague memories of it. We were at our grandparents' house watching it, right?
Correct, yeah.
And I remember it being really sunny outside, and that's really it. Like, the game itself, I remember very little of. Also, just not really feeling like it was that competitive of a game, I suppose. Like, throughout it,
well, it felt compared to what we'd been used to that season.
Clearly. UW kind of just controlled the entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Although maybe not as much as we thought, because Purdue did tie it at one point. So that's it. We've wrapped up the 2000 season. We've remembered it. And now we are ready next week to start prepping for this abbreviated 2020 campaign, whatever it goes on to look like.
Really? A lot happened in that 2000 Husky season. Have to say, there were some highs and lows. There were some moments that in hindsight have made us really think about how we approach the entire sport of college football. But ultimately, I think it was a very fun team. And, you know, seeing how football has transformed in these last two decades from how it was played in the year 2000, looking at the completion percentages, at the interceptions that happened then, it's pretty interesting how, honestly, they're playing a completely different sport at this point.
Yep. Yes, they are. Well, sticking with the same sport but a different level, let's talk about the Seahawks. If you haven't already, probably don't listen to the post-game pod. It was a tough one. It was a tough loss. Much like 2016, the needle started out really high for the Seahawks, and then was lower, but still pretty good. And then it was very low.
Oh, Lord. That was not a comparison I was expecting. But can I let you know some additional thoughts from the game after sure. taking a second to think about it?
Yeah.
What the fuck? They should have won this game.
Yeah.
The more that I think about it, I'm just like, these little plays, right? Where it's like, you know, if they, I'm going to have people coming out of their bedrooms yelling at me. That was a loud scream. If Benson Mayo doesn't have that leverage, we already fought about this yesterday, because we'll fight about this every single day until Sunday. Like that, if they get a field goal there, the Seahawks win this game. If the Seahawks obviously get 2 yards following that, they win this game. It was so easy. There were so many different possibilities. Think about this. The Seahawks had the ball 2 times in overtime and yep. couldn't get into field goal range. Like when they won the coin toss, I'm like, great, we're going to win. Right? Like,
you're definitely thinking like, don't even settle for a field goal. You need to score the touchdown here.
It's crazy that, I mean, it's awesome that we have that perspective about the Seahawks offense. And I think the long completion of David Moore happened on the first drive in overtime. And then it just stalled out. But then also you look back at it and you're like, oh, if they just hadn't had, I think it was probably a proper holding that they called on David Moore, but it's
it was definitely a holding, but he didn't need to do it.
He didn't need to do it. And also there are times that doesn't get called. Like, couldn't that have just been a play that Cardinals fans bitch about on Twitter after, you know, where they isolate it and they're like, look at this hold. And then we're like, yeah, sorry, 6-0. Like all of these things could have happened and none of it happened. Even the second field goal, I would have taken a tie, right? There would have kind of been a fun synergy 4 years apart, 2 ties in Arizona, but no, the second field goal hitting the goalpost, like,
Wait, did it hit the goalpost?
Yeah. It hit the goalpost and sort of snuck in. I was talking to Jan earlier tonight, which as usual was a mistake. And Jan was like, don't the Seahawks always lose in Arizona? And I was like, if I recall correctly, they have not lost in Arizona since Russell Wilson's rookie year.
Well, they have not lost to the Cardinals in Arizona. Oh, no. Oh, no. I broke you again.
Not in a fun way. But they haven't lost to the Cardinals in Arizona since Russell Wilson's rookie year, right?
That is correct, yes.
I was like, Jan, no. They win in Arizona. They lose in Seattle in December in the worst loss of the season.
Correct.
That's how this works. Look, we better make up for this. When do they play the Cardinals at home?
I'm not seeing anything online about this hitting the upright.
And maybe it did. Maybe it just looked like it did. It sort of snuck in, though.
Well, the good news is it's not in December. They host the Cardinals on Thursday night, November 19th.
They've got to make up for it. This is the deal. Like you gave up one there that you should win. You have to win here now. Sorry, Pete. You got to beat the Cardinals at home for once.
Going to have to play against type. Some injury news coming out of that one. Chris Carson is expected week to week dealing with a midfoot sprain that was confirmed by MRI. Shaquille Griffin is in concussion protocol and also dealing with a hamstring injury. And Travis Homer dealing with a knee bruise that kept him off the field. I don't know if we mentioned that in the postgame pod, but
there was a non-block by DJ Dallas at the end of the game that was majestic.
Let me tell you, Seahawks Twitter will be debating it for days and days, I'm sure. The other thing that came out of this game is like, anyone who's holding out hope for the Seahawks defense, granted, they still were without Jamal Adams, who hopefully will be back this week. Haven't heard a lot about his status yet because it's too early in the week. The defense is just not getting better right now. Down to 28th in defensive DVOA.
How much of a difference do you think Jamal Adams will make?
He'll definitely make a difference. Like
some.
He's a playmaker, and the Seahawks, I mean, they still have some of those on defense with Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright. They just, none of them happen to play defensive line. I mean, maybe the biggest aspect will be what he does as a pass rusher.
Yes. Yeah. But it's also like when we were talking about how when the Seahawks got near Kyler in this last game, it really felt like there was no chance of bringing him down. If Jamal Adams is on the field, I do not have that same perspective. Jamal Adams can pass rush with an effective pass rush plus speed and tackling ability. Like, he brings a different package to the table when pursuing somebody like Kyler.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance of at least one sack with Jamal Adams. 2 first round picks, 1 sack.
There you go. That's why you give up those 2 first round picks. Let's talk about the 49ers who come to town on Sunday. They sat 2-3 after a 43-17 home loss to Miami in week 5, where Jimmy Garoppolo sat during the second half due to his high ankle sprain that he was returning from. And then with a week later, restored order in a 24-16 Sunday Night Football win over the Rams, and then crushed the Patriots 33-6 on Sunday in New England to improve to 4-3. They have climbed all the way from 17th after week 5 to 8th in DVOA, one spot ahead of the Seahawks.
DVOA?
Yes.
The Seahawks are 9th?
Yes. Basically, all that improvement has come on offense, where they've gone from 24th to 8th in the past few weeks. They are number 2 in rushing DVOA, despite dealing with a series of running back injuries as well. Raheem Mostert has missed 3 games. Is on
who
IR.
Do you think is the worst running back that you could put in a Kyle Shanahan offense and be successful?
Maybe let's say who's the running back you could put in a Kyle Shanahan offense and would not be successful. I mean, like, I feel like Travis Homer was down there. Travis Homer would be ripping off 4.8.
Oh yeah, no, no question. It's like, is Frank Gore rejuvenated Frank Gore in a Kyle Shanahan offense?
It's possible. I mean, the upgrade from the Jets offensive line to the 49ers offensive line in the scheme is considerable.
What if, okay, they have a lot of injuries at running back. Let's say Jamichael Hasty gets injured. All of a sudden, we've got Kyle Juszczyk starting running back for the 49ers. Is he averaging 5+ yards per carry?
He probably isn't, because then he couldn't be blocking for himself.
I suppose that's a good point.
You know what I was going to say? I know that they're not his team. I know they're the wrong side of the peninsula. But beast mode 49ers running back. Anyways, Raheem Mostert has missed 3 games. Tevin Coleman has missed 5. He might be back this week. Jeff Wilson had been the most successful of the 49ers backs on the ground, but he suffered a high ankle sprain last week and joined Mostert on IR. So all Jamichael Hasty did was rip off 57 yards on 9 carries the rest of the game. They also have Jerick McKinnon, who has not been especially effective as a runner this season, coming back from missing his first two years in San Francisco with season-ending injuries, but has been a very effective screen receiver coming out of the backfield. So that's something to watch for with McKinnon and really all of the 49ers running backs, because they're very good at this, because Kyle Shanahan. The passing attack was pretty good in New England, with Garoppolo completing 20 of his 25 passes for 277 yards, albeit with 2 interceptions. Garoppolo ranks 8th in DVOA, but is in the middle of the pack in Ben Baldwin's Dakota stat because of his below average completion percentage over expectation. You know, much of what he's benefiting from in DVOA is probably attributable to the scheme and the big playability of the receivers. But clearly the offense was way better with Garoppolo at the helm than Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard, who struggled pretty badly in a couple of the losses there. Mullins did start, I think, the weight game they won at the Giants. And yeah, interceptions remain a bugaboo for Garoppolo, as the 8th highest interception rate in the NFL this season. 49ers will be down one of their playmakers at receiver this week, with Deebo Samuel suffering a hamstring injury just as he was working back from a Jones fracture in his foot that sidelined him the first 3 weeks of the season. Obviously, the biggest threat in the passing game for them is still George Kittle, who is catching 78% of his targets for 9.7 yards per target. And then I would also say watch out for end arounds and sweeps to rookie Brandon Ayuk. Half of his 4 carries have gone for touchdowns.
I think that is the most essential part of the Kyle Shanahan offense.
The wide receiver run?
I really do. And I think it's about having somebody to do it effectively. You know, it's partially, I think, why they drafted Brandon Ayuk to do stuff like this.
Oh, yeah.
And both having Deebo and Brandon Ayuk is huge, but if they are without, like, Debo picked those carries back up, I want to say this last week early before he got injured again. These are going to go back to Ayuk.
They also have just been lining up Debo at running back at times this
really
season. Yeah, which has been interesting.
It is an essential part of their offense, and it really opens up the motion for them. You know, pre-step motion is such a huge part of the Kyle Shanahan offense, and you know, I think they talked about this, maybe it was the Niners Rams game on a couple of Sunday nights ago, but the setting the edge as being so important for a defense, being able to set that edge and keep everything in front of you. Can the Seahawks defense do this?
Well, I give them a better chance of that than putting pressure on Garoppolo, I guess.
That is the thing. It's like the idea of pressure is probably a non-starter in a lot of ways. And if Jamal Adams is back, I feel a little bit better about that notion of, again, having that speed coming off the edge in the place that Jamal Adams is typically lined up for the Seahawks. Misdirection is one thing that I don't think the Seahawks defense does particularly well with. But at the same time, can they, we talked about this last week, can they stop big plays and force first down after first down after first down into punt, or first down after first down after first down into field goal, right? Like that to me is going to be the biggest thing, is are they going to hold the 49ers? Like the 49ers are going to move the ball. And it's going to be ridiculously frustrating. They literally have possibly, and maybe this is because the Seahawks are in the division, three of the most frustrating offenses to play in the NFL in their division.
Yep.
Especially for what they do.
They did a decent job against the Niners last season, I would say. I mean, you know, not
a surprisingly decent job against the Niners.
Right.
I think there's something about the Jordan Brooks pick that they really wanted speed at linebacker for shit like this, though. Like,
I mean, they did a decent job against the 49ers, but they got destroyed by the Rams in LA. That was the game where it was really like their lack of speed was exposed. Their overplaying and being vulnerable to misdirection was exposed. Just everything went wrong in that game.
But I think that there's an element of the Jordan Brooks pick was because of this and what these teams in division do. He looked okay on Sunday against Kyler. Didn't show up a ton. You know, Jordan Brooks hasn't really made a play yet this year, I want to say. But the defensive line
isn't flashed.
I mean, I haven't seen anything in particular, but the defensive line is kind of taken out of these games, right? This is a linebacker and secondary game. And I think it's going to be a linebacker and secondary game, which, you know, maybe fortunately for the Seahawks is a bit of their strength until they get into third and long, and then we'll see. It's another game where you look at it and you're just like, man, they released Anthony Rush this week, and so you assume that Snacks is going to be active. It's not a Snacks game, though, right?
I mean, you may still need him because the threat of, you know, the ability to run up the middle is still an element of what they're trying to do.
Yes, it's nice to have a big body in the middle, as you would say.
For them, you know, for other teams, you think about like, well, the motion and the sweeps and the end arounds, those are the constraint plays. In their case, the running straight up the middle is the constraint play, and the other stuff is what they actually do well.
Yes. That's it's the offense. It is a side-to-side offense and open things up down the field for Jimmy G to get the ball to George Kittle, right? It is a concern yourself with the player in motion offense where your linebacker is so consumed with the player in motion that they're not thinking about George Kittle behind them, right?
Yeah.
That's what they want. That's what Kyle Shanahan wants in this offense, is he wants you to be consumed with Brandon Ayuk on the end around. He wants you to be consumed with those plays and to forget that George Kittle exists and to open up space for George Kittle to make a monster play.
Never forget that George Kittle exists.
I have some faith in these Seahawks linebackers. Like, are they going to stop the Niners that many times? Obviously not. You know, we're not naive, right? But can they get off the field? they got off the field against the Cardinals just enough times to possibly win that game and ended up on the wrong side because of some untimely penalties. But can they do the same thing against the Niners? I feel like this Niners, where do they rank DVOA wise, Cardinals versus Niners on offense?
Let's see. I only know that overall all four teams in the NFC West are between 7th and 11th, I believe.
Oh my God.
It's a very tight range. Offensively, so again, San Francisco is 8th, Arizona is 11th.
Interesting.
Arizona, and then basically equivalent on defense, San Francisco 8th, Arizona is 9th. Well, the offense was good. I don't know if you need to be making faces about that part of it.
It's, man.
Should we talk about the 49ers defense?
Well, so I just want to say, I think that it's slightly different, and I do think it plays maybe, I think that this particular offense might play a little bit more to the Seahawks' strengths than the Cardinals' offense does.
They might have a shittier quarterback.
There's no might about it. They have a shittier quarterback.
Stop me if you've heard this before, but the Niners' defense has also been hit hard by injury. They lost Nick Bosa and Solomon Thomas to season-ending ACL tears in week 2. D Ford, because of a back injury, and our old friend Richard Sherman, because of a calf injury, both haven't played since week 1, and yet still a top 10 DVOA defense. They've gotten great play from Jason Verrett, who had played just 6 total games before this season since making the 2015 Pro Bowl. He stepped in for Sherman. And then linebacker Fred Warner has really emerged as a star in his 3rd season. Tony Romo called him the best linebacker in football during Sunday's game when he picked off Cam Newton for his 2nd interception in the season. And I'm sure Bob Wagner did not take note of that at all.
The best linebacker in football? Or Khalil Mack?
I assume that he's saying off-ball linebacker. Mack's in kind of a different category. He's an edge rusher. The Niners also don't get a ton of pressure without Bosa and Ford. They are number 24 in pass rush win rate, according to ESPN, and number 23 in sack rate, a stat in which the Seahawks, of course, rank 29th.
I think this is good news for the Seahawks, though. That pressure is what throws Russell Wilson off, right? And everybody, you know, all quarterbacks are thrown off by pressure. But that's what the second half against the Cardinals, where he really got flustered.
I mean, 2 things throw off Russell Wilson. And the other good news is the forecast at this point, mostly sunny.
There we go.
Less than a 10% chance of rain.
Yeah, I think that the Seahawks are going to move the ball comfortably in this game.
Yeah, I think so too.
I don't see that being an issue, you know? I mean, you talk about those defensive linemen being down, players in the secondary. Like, I believe that Russell Wilson can, outside of pressure, do well against basically any secondary. I don't think that there is any secondary in the league that can stop him from doing well. The pressure and the exotic pressure is what I think is especially an issue, but like...
You gotta be careful of that exotic pressure.
Oh, yeah.
Especially during the pandemic.
Yeah, the exotic smash mouth. Russ is going to, they're going to score points, you know? And can they hold the Niners to field goals a couple times, you know? Like, it's one of those things where I feel like we expect, like, oh, yeah, the Seahawks should go down and score every time, and then they should get a stop. And the reality is that's not what
a stop.
It's a stop in the game. That's not what this defense is. They're going to give up points. They're going to give up first down after first down after first down. And it's going to be frustrating as hell. But can the Seahawks score enough points to arm's length the Niners in this game? I feel like there's a chance given, which they almost did against Arizona. They almost arm's length Arizona. And they were 1 or 2 plays away from it. Is Russell Wilson going to throw 3 picks again? Hell no, though. Right? Maybe.
I will definitely take the under on that one.
So, especially in those like crucial moments, even if they're field goals, I think the Seahawks get to 30 plus in this game.
That's I was going to say 28. So maybe that's not that different.
And do you have a chance as a victory?
I am going 55% on this one.
55%? Wow, that's conservative, I have to say.
I mean, I think the 49ers are probably a better team at this point than the Seahawks. They did go to the Super Bowl last year. I don't know if you heard. Granted, a lot of injuries, but they're better than DVOA. That's despite starting Nick Mullins and playing CJ Beathard for 2.5 games combined.
Definitely cannot get to the point where I'm saying that a team that is quarterbacked by Jimmy Garoppolo is a better team than a team quarterbacked by Russell Wilson.
I mean, this is the genius of the 49ers that they have managed to overcome being quarterbacked by Jimmy Garoppolo to go to the Super Bowl last year.
How many points did they lose to the Dolphins by?
A lot.
Jimmy Garoppolo still started that game, did he not?
It was not Jimmy Garoppolo. Like, you know, the footage that SNF had comparing his footwork in that game with versus when he was healthy, and then again in the Rams game when he was more healthy, it was night and day.
The Seahawks don't get beat like they got beat in that game.
I agree with that. The Seahawks are always going to find a way, almost always going to find a way to make it close somehow. But they also don't beat New England by 26 points the way the 49ers did. I mean, maybe Cam Newton is just that broken, and we're going to find out this week that, you know.
I mean, Cam Newton's on the brink of getting – who did they lose to the previous week?
The Patriots?
Yeah.
Not someone particularly – Denver.
Oh, they got – They've been destroyed 2 weeks in a row.
The 49ers also beat the Rams the week before. Like, look, the 49ers are good again.
I'm not questioning whether the 49ers – obviously the 49ers are good. If I had to do like a – here we go. Fast food week 1 through 4 of the NFC West. I don't know how to rank these teams, right?
It's you could put them in almost literally any order and it would make sense.
I mean, I think that's literally true. 1 through 4, any order of teams, you could argue that that's the case.
So doesn't it then stand to reason that you should just basically be going with, you know, giving the Seahawks a slight edge because of home field here?
I still think that the Seahawks are a better team than the 49ers. I think this is more like a 63-64% chance of victory.
I'm maybe also a little chastened because I gave the Seahawks a 70% chance of victory last week. And
they should have fucking won! Are you joking? Like, they won this game. You are looking at this not process-based. You're looking at it outcome-based.
I mean,
I know you don't understand how that works.
Thanks. Yes.
Just because they lost doesn't mean that they were outplayed.
But it was a close game throughout. Like, your arm's length, I'm not sure I quite buy. They had the advantage, but they also, you know, had a goal line stop. You know, there was many turnovers in regulation on each side.
Okay. I don't agree with that. I think the Seahawks were 1 to 2 plays away from having a 2+ touchdown lead throughout that game. I mean, Russ threw a pick in the end zone that got brought back almost 100 yards. Like, the Cardinals didn't capitalize on it, and that's your goal line stop that you're talking about. But how many times in Russ's career has he done that? Almost never.
Well, you know, almost exclusively happened in the same end zone, as it turns out.
Can you?
So good news, they only play in that stadium once a year. I mean, you brought it up. I didn't bring it up.
Didn't bring it back.
No, there was not a return on that one.
Look, some of us are over this, right?
Yes, I can tell.
You're over here like Richard Sherman. You're still consumed by it. You're going to sign with the 49ers just because Russell Wilson threw one pick one time. Dog, we're winning the Super Bowl this year. Move on, bro. Move on.org.
pretty sure Richard Sherman got released by the Seahawks. I don't think he was like, yeah, I'm out of here. I'm going to
He got released by the Seahawks because he couldn't get past this. And then he went and signed with the Seahawks' biggest rival because he couldn't get past this one reception. It's 2020. The Seahawks are going back to the Super Bowl this year. Don't worry.
Look, there's going to be a lot of worrying in the next.
Yeah, here being like Jason Verrett. Come on.
There's going to be a lot of worrying in the next 7 days. Okay. We'll see how much of it is on Sunday afternoon.
Oh, Lord. It'll be fun watching football. That's all I can take away from this.
Yes. I mean, this should be a good game. These two teams played two indisputably classic games last year. You have no comment on this?
I hate the NFC West.
you watch the Rams play the Bears. And it's like, man, when do we get to play the Bears? Which we actually get to. We get our stretch at the end of the season. It's coming.
It's but not against the Bears, but
there's a lot of, well,
our stretch is actually even easier. We still haven't been through that stretch.
These teams all got that stretch already. Like the schedules are the same in terms of the NFC yes. and the AFCs.
They all got their freebies.
Although some people are going to get to play the Cowboys with possibly Andy Dalton and possibly Ben DiNucci at quarterback, as opposed to Dak Prescott early in the season. That will not necessarily be a fair trade-off, I guess.
Have the Niners not played the Cowboys yet?
They play them in week 15.
Oh, Lord. Oh.
So they are the only ones from the NFC West who have not yet got to feast on the carcass of the Dallas Cowboys.
Well, the Rams and the Seahawks both had Dak.
Correct.
And then the Cardinals had Dalton, and the Niners will have
TBD. Kellen Moore?
I would love that. Kellen Moore, Tony Romo, Jameis Winston, Colin Kaepernick. Who knows? Oh, Lord. Well, I'm just looking forward to Sunday at this point. And I have to say, like, calendar-wise, I think it's going to be really fun the way that this lines up with Halloween on Saturday. It's supposed to be clear and cold, going into daylight savings, and then that Sunday waking up and having, again, another supposedly... As the forecasts I've seen have been perfectly sunny and cold football, and it's kind of Russ weather.
It definitely is. Yeah.
So I'm excited to watch the game.
I mean, it's not even that cold. It's a high of 58 on Sunday.
There you go.
For the first Sunday of November, we'll take it.
Yeah.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.